The Antichrist is a three-tiered system, comprised of different levels of Christian extremism. Essentially, the Antichrist was blueprinted by white Christian supremacists, assembled by Christian nationalists, and finally exploited by a violent Christofascist. Now that we know core operations of the Antichrist, let's take a look at how it was developed. Welcome back. I'm your host, Valerie, and this is Anti. See the system. Though it is a system, the Antichrist is given a physical description in Revelation 13, verses 1 through 8. The Message translation says, quote, "And the dragon stood on the shore of the sea. I saw a beast rising from the sea. It had 10 horns and 7 heads, on each horn a crown, and each head inscribed with a blasphemous name. The beast I saw looked like a leopard with bear paws and a lion's mouth. The dragon turned over its power to it, its throne and great authority. One of the beast's heads looked as if it had been struck a death blow, and then healed. The whole world was agog, gaping at the beast. They worshiped the dragon who gave the beast authority, and they worshiped the beast, exclaiming, 'There's never been anything like the beast. No one would dare go to war with the beast.' The beast had a loud mouth, boastful and blasphemous. It could do anything it wanted for 42 months. It yelled blasphemies against God, blasphemed his name, blasphemed his church, especially those already dwelling with God in heaven. It was permitted to make war on God's holy people and conquer them. It held absolute sway over all tribes and peoples, tongues and races. Everyone on earth whose name was not written from the world's foundation in the Slaughtered Lamb's Book of Life will worship the beast." End quote. First, let's address some common misconceptions. Some people believe that by this point in Scripture, all of the believers in God will either have been raptured or somehow excluded from this period of tribulation. Some will be spared, yes, but not all. Clearly here, there are still believers in the earth that the Antichrist is allowed to make war against. We know this Antichrist system is a political one because of its description in verse 1. Contrary to the description of the red dragon in Revelation 12, verse 3, one crown for each of its 7 heads, this beast has a crown for each of its 10 horns. The beast has the same number of heads as the dragon because that is where it gets its power. However, the dragon has crowns on its heads because Satan is the one in charge. The Antichrist system has crowns on its horns because in Jewish symbolism, a horn represents one king, which is a generic term for a figurehead. In America, for example, this would have to be a president or a major head of the other two branches of government, such as the Attorney General or a SCOTUS member. Because the eschatological will of God is global and includes all people from all nations, we cannot simply interpret this from the vantage of one particular nation. Revelations has a global outcome, so the Antichrist has to be understood within the context of world order, not just the norms of one particular nation. This political interpretation of this passage might be difficult or repulsive for some listeners to hear, because some may believe God is apolitical. But Jesus is evidence God is politically involved. There was a man called Son of God, God, Lord, and Sovereign. Before Jesus was ever born, that man was Augustus Caesar. Tiberius, the Caesar who reigned for most of Jesus' life, was addressed by the same terms. For Jewish citizens to then give the titles of the Roman emperor to a Jewish peasant, all while under Roman rule, is quite literally one of the loudest political messages in history. Jesus could have corrected the public if they were wrong, but instead, he validates his disciples' view of him, Joseph ben Caiaphas' view, and even Pilate's view of him, which ultimately sealed his lawful crucifixion. God is not politically threatened, but he is most certainly politically involved. Now, I'll provide an interpretation of this passage. The Antichrist is comprised of a network of national leaders and political figures tied together by a worldview that is contrary to the inclusive kingdom of God, a violent, discriminatory, totalitarian, and often fascist worldview. The Antichrist sighting in Revelation 13:1 does not represent its beginning, but rather an existential paradigm shift compared to previous waves of power. This sighting marks the official rise to power of the Antichrist, because after it recovers from this deadly wound, it will gather followers to participate in the last rebellion, a final Armageddon campaign set against the campaign of Christ, which is the gospel. The conglomerate body of the Antichrist reveals the three strongest parts of the systematic movement: its body or structure, its feet or influence, and its mouth or message and propaganda. The lion, leopard, and bear symbolize Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece on one layer, but eschatologically, they represent increasingly violent degrees of Christian extremism. So now, let's see the system for what it is. Let's look at three major phases of the Antichrist development. We will see as history advances that the structure, influence, and message come together piece by piece, developing a fully functioning Antichrist system by the 1900s. Revelation 13, therefore, is not talking about the first ever sighting of the Antichrist, but merely the exposure of it, after it had been working overtime behind the scenes to prevent the kingdom of God from growing. Inception. There are numerous historical accounts that could help us track the development of the Antichrist over time. However, there are two I want to focus on: the evolution of human trafficking and the rise of the Christian Church. I believe that as we review the interplay of these two, we will see there is a system of demagoguery, convicting, urging, empowering, and commanding the political extremist church. Let's start with human trafficking, which includes forced labor or abuse, sexual exploitation, and slavery. Slavery in particular had always been some form of either punishment or indebtedness. According to Joel Panzer, author of The Popes and Slavery, quote, "The earlier forms of servitude were varied, complex, and very often of a different sociological category than those which were prevalent after the 14th century," end quote. As far as what can be traced as early as 11,000 years ago, slavery became more popular and more cruel as agricultural technology improved. The agricultural revolution changed hunting and gathering into harvest and settlement, starkly decreasing nomadic living and increasing the survivability and longevity of large populations. The concept of personal land was indeed a paradigm shift for humanity. Kind of like how computers and phones made the postal service seem irrelevant, or how a brand new car puts the old one under its shadow, newer or more expensive things have a way of outmoding older or common ones. So when it came to the paradigm shift of land settlement, with that new mountain in the slave owner's backyard, I cannot imagine how much smaller and more worthless that suddenly made the slave seem in comparison. Like pretty much everything else, slavery has become increasingly advanced, and technologically, economically, and politically. This means more slaves en masse. Rather than drafting slaves by necessity, it became a show of force, a flex. This means more vicious methods of separation, crueler methods of dominance. Take the infamous 1492 invasion of America, for example. With the intent to force the natives into Christianity, Christopher Columbus wrote this, quote, "They are very simple and honest, and exceedingly liberal with all they have, none of them refusing anything he may possess when he has asked for it. They exhibit great love toward all others in preference to themselves. They are the best people in the world, and above all the gentlest, without knowledge of what is evil, nor do they murder or steal. They love their neighbors as themselves, and they have the sweetest talk in the world, always laughing. They would make fine servants. With 50 men, we can subjugate them all," end quote. There's no way to make this a smooth transition here, but now let's talk about the Christian Church. "50 days after Jesus had ascended into heaven, the Paraclete empowered a group of believers in a certain upper room in Jerusalem to preach the gospel in various languages so that every person within earshot could understand. On that day, 3,000 people were saved, and Peter established the first church, initiating the beginning of an enduring movement. The slur Christians was used by the Roman government and Pharisaic leadership to specifically target and persecute Peter and the other apostles who followed Jesus. Only over time was it used to generally identify believers in Jesus. Thanks to the leadership of Peter and many great apostles and teachers, Christianity survived not one, not two, but 10 Roman emperors. 240 years of incessant waves of persecution, violent oppression, and Roman opposition could not snuff out the light of the gospel. Finally, persecution was brought to an end. Although most likely for political gain, the Emperor Constantine issued an order of tolerance for the Christians. Constantine ordered the Nicene Council to officialize the pillars of the Christian faith, as wide factions had caused division in the church between the Egyptian theologian Pope Athanasius and the Libyan hermit Arius. It was from this episcopal delegation that Christianity received the earliest version of the Nicene Creed in the summer of 325 AD. Christian monasticism had rejuvenated the ascetic lifestyle by this time, with movements starting as early as 251 AD in northern Africa. Despite some arguments against its extremes, abbot-run monasteries rapidly spread in size and influence, providing education and community service to many in need, and they helped to sustain the Christian movement in the face of oppression. Their movement taught us that an organization's true might lies in the value of its community service, not in the number of its political achievements. In 380, Emperor Theodosius made Christianity the official state religion. But the Western Roman Empire fell to the Germans, first the Goths, and then the Franks. Rulers were either peaceful toward or recognized by Catholic leaders. During roughly the same span of time, Christianity survived Islamic rule and expansion in Africa. Christianity expanded in all directions, including to England, China, Russia, and America. As any group of innocent people who survived mass persecution, Christianity strived for international political power, partly motivated by a sense of righteous indignation. And there's nothing wrong with that, unless said righteous indignation turns into righteous cruelty. Cruelty often comes from a false sense of divine justice, which is rooted in evil, and Scripture tells us the root of all evil is corporate greed. We call the church version of corporate greed the prosperity gospel. Encouragement in hard times and using hardship as an excuse to be entitled to wealth and prosperity are two completely different things. I can be hopeful I'll come out of poverty, but if I actually hate poverty, that means I have an image problem, not a money problem. So it was generally this innocuous, unwitting insecurity that corrupts the best of people, turning even the pious into religious monsters. Struggle already creates stress, so adding a hatred of struggle into the mix, now you have a motivated stress, which becomes anger over time. At some point, hate-driven anger has to be released. And if you do not have the direct source of your frustration available to unload upon, you displace that hate-fueled anger onto someone who doesn't deserve it. And I didn't even add the fact that hardship makes you tired. A weary soul with mismanaged, hate-driven anger is easily manipulated and deceived, even by the slightest inconveniences. Then one day, before you know it, hatred looks like simply maintaining personal boundaries, and abusing others just look like survival mode or self-preservation. Congratulations, you are officially evil. And that's just one person. I haven't added the fact that entire factions of Christianity have done this throughout the past two millennia. As with every other religion in the world, Christianity is neither all good nor all bad. I don't believe anything in the world is. But I do not fear the wicked who can no longer tell apart good from evil. I fear the good who can't. No man knows how bad he is, till he has tried very hard to be good. C.S. Lewis. Perfect Storm. Now, it took more than the rise of Christianity and the commercialization of human trafficking to get the Antichrist system up and running. After all, the Antichrist supposedly has been alive and well since Nero. However, these two factors were probably the most powerful catalysts that gained the Antichrist influence and support in one single historical atrocity, and on a global scale at that. I also need to be very clear. By acknowledging Christian expansion and human trafficking as contributors to the Antichrist, I am absolutely indicting both. The Antichrist would not have been able to achieve all that it has over the last two decades without certain Christian factions and human trafficking holding hands under the table, and more recently, blatantly out in the open. Christianity's long-standing refusal to deal with its own toxicity and human trafficking's value of power over the value of life is without question the worst possible combination that came together at the worst possible time in history. Christianity is by no means perfect, but the one time I expect Christians to band together for love and justice for all is in between world wars. Christianity did not merely falter, but intentionally stooped to its lowest. What historical event am I talking about? You know, the one foreseen by Ezekiel, Hebrew priest and prophet. Ezekiel had many powerful visions, but one in particular revealed one of Christianity's darkest stains. I'll read from the New King James Version out of Ezekiel 37. The hand of the Lord came upon me and brought me out in the spirit of the Lord and set me down in the midst of the valley, and it was full of bones. Then he caused me to pass by them all around, and behold, there were very many in the open valley, and indeed they were very dry. Verse 11 says, Then he said to me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. This first part of the vision came to pass between the years 1933 and 1945 in Germany under Nazi control, run by a nominal Christian named Adolf Hitler, the man centrally responsible for the Holocaust. Vengeance for God. It was an event that targeted primarily Jews, but also the disabled, Black Germans, Jehovah's Witnesses, Communists, Romans, Poles, and Soviet civilians and prisoners of war. This crime against humanity, the Holocaust, or the Shoah, took place during World War II, between 1941 and 1945. Nazi Germany and its collaborators systematically murdered some 6 million Jews across German-occupied Europe. Two-thirds, I say again, two-thirds of Europe's Jewish population. Pogroms, mass shootings, concentration camps, gas chambers and gas vans. But they didn't persecute all at once. They organized this mass genocide in stages. Adolf Hitler was appointed as Chancellor January 30, 1933. His Nazi regime built a network of concentration camps in Germany for political opponents and those deemed as undesirable or asocial, starting with Dachau on March 22, 1933. Much of Hitler's hatred for the Jews stemmed from anti-Semitic teachings he was brought up under. Jews had been painted as the murderers of Jesus, and in Hitler's mind, they didn't deserve to continue to exist. Wielding the Aryan myth to his advantage, Hitler argued Jesus was an Aryan activist, so Hitler took it upon himself to thuggishly take vengeance for God, as if he himself was some sort of political, infallible godhead. Secretly, Hitler may have possibly been a deist, unable to distinguish science and nature from God. Both persecution and appeasing the religious influencers were mere tools for Hitler to maintain his image for political gains. Hitler really didn't like religions, but that didn't stop him from using it to further his own interests. Therefore, some experts believed Hitler merely used Christianity as a sort of mask to distinguish his own lawlessness from that of the communists in the eyes of his voters. In the same week the systematic killings got underway, Hitler made a promise to the majority Catholic party to protect the interests of the Catholic Church. With a whiff of 30 pieces of silver, the Catholic Party supported the bill that made Hitler dictator. More money? No problem. When Hitler concluded his victory speech, it was noted that the Catholic Party was cheering him on. For his entire military political career, Hitler was hell-bent on rescuing Germany from its economic woes and possibly literally believed that he was the one alone who could fix it. And the Catholic Party celebrated him for it. The Catholic Party, too, shared this sense of divine entitlement to prosperity. You could say the Catholic Party was suffering from a stress motivated by the love of money, motivated by a hate-driven stress enough to destroy one race under the false pretense of saving their own. And when that displaced anger reached its boiling point, it anesthetized their consciences, making their hatred of hardship and the weak seem more like a mere personal boundary, and abusing the Jews look like heroic acts of preserving the Aryan race. Oh, true, there was a heavy air of terror brought on by Hitler and his regime, which I believe some of every group feared, but the Catholic Party wasn't terrified as much as they were tempted. Right away, the government escalated their self-sanctioned persecution of the Jews, starting April 1933, and terror did not cease until the end of World War II in Europe in May 1945. The name of the chairman in the Catholic Party responsible for voting in Hitler as dictator was Ludwig Kuss. He had a faction of the Catholic Party that was willing to choose protecting their religion over standing up for God's people. Chancellor Heinrich Brunig called the Enabling Act the most monstrous resolutions ever demanded of a parliament. I couldn't agree more. Justified by hate. Hitler had a hate so big, even Ezekiel saw it coming. But this hatred was not the first of its kind. Hitler got his thinking from somewhere. Major thanks to one anti-Semitic theologian named Martin Luther. It wasn't pagan hate that undergirded the success of the Holocaust. Christian hate did that. Martin Luther was a German professor of theology, priest, and seminal leader of the Reformation. His positions on Judaism changed dramatically from his early career, where he showed concern for the plight of the European Jews, to his later years, when embittered by his failure to convert them to Christianity, he became outspokenly anti-Semitic in his statements and writings. It's the same hatred the Catholic Party showed centuries later. Much of Christian hate is based on the need to protect God, religious traditions, or religious exploits, rather than people. Luther only denounced Judaism and called for harsh persecutions against its followers because he was petty. In a paragraph from his On Jews and Their Lies, Luther deplores Christendom's failure to expel them. Moreover, he proposed, quote, "What shall we Christians do with this rejected and condemned people, the Jews? First, to set fire to their synagogues or schools. This is to be done in honor of our Lord and of Christendom, so that God might see that we are Christians." End quote. And that was just one of many. Although hatred of the outsider made the Holocaust propaganda attractive to the common German, it was hatred of the weak that was the prime driver of the actual cruelty of the Holocaust. The Jewish final solution was a Nazi order of systemized human trafficking for labor, torture, or violation to the death. To Hitler, everyone was weak or a threat except the healthy Aryan. There is a report by a German doctor about Hitler's survival of child abuse, and therefore I believe that Hitler was triggered into psychopathy by trauma. Even though I believe Hitler was an undiagnosed psychopath, everyone who followed him wasn't. We know why Hitler hated non-Aryans, but why did the Nazis? They supported Hitler's belief in social Darwinism. Basically, it was a human version of survival of the fittest. Hitler used this to excuse unprovoked war and inhumane acts because he valued the primitive human instinct to survive. Nazis believed killing off the weak and non-Aryans would avert the extinction of their race. Nazis feared interracial procreation. And to expand their Aryan Empire fantasy, they would need space, which the Jews were occupying a lot of. Hitler used the propaganda of Joseph Goebbels to sway Germans against the Jews and become more sympathetic of anti-Semitic laws or doctrine. This not only made anti-Semitism popular, but Hitler too. One would think that an autopsy on the fall of the Nazi regime would have led people to realize its principles were doomed to failure. But no. Christofascism was actually fueled by the Holocaust after World War II ended. Dorothy Zola was a German theologian who coined the term Christofascism. Being born in 1929, she watched the Holocaust unfold right before her young eyes. Sarah Pinnock commented on her work in a publication in the Trinity Press International, explaining that people like Hitler often used a, quote, dubious moral superiority to justify organized violence on a massive scale, a perversion of Christianity known as Christofascism, end quote. Christofascism thrives on factional divides, especially between superior and less deserving groups. Zola believed it was Christofascism that led to a major uptick in Christian supremacy, which gave rise to many Christian extremist groups born in America and around the world from the 1940s to the 2000s. Christofascism doesn't want salvation for all. It wants triumph over all. The fangs of Christofascism are sunk deep into the role of God, particularly God's role in the book of Revelation. In Revelation 14, God is the great reaper. In the depiction of the harvest and the winepress, where the grapes of wrath are stored, God is also the judge in Revelation 20. God alone is responsible for judging the hearts of humanity and determining who spends eternity in heaven and who spends eternity in the lake of fire. Christian fascists have the idea that this is their role in the earth in the here and now, in addition to God's role on Judgment Day. They, in effect, see themselves as an extension of God, using their long-standing prosperity from white supremacy as justification that their continued dominion over all others is God-sanctioned. Christian fascists believe they are supposed to use Christianity to judge the world as they see fit and triumph over them. The evil torment and cruelty that they inflict upon others is perceived as a deserved punishment. Christian nationalism. Christian anti-Semitism, aporophobia, and Christofascism dovetailed throughout the early 1900s, marrying the worst aspects of the Christian right, capitalism, politics, and Americanism into what is now widely known as Christian nationalism. With strong roots in white supremacy, Christian nationalism solidified into a movement after World War II based on a false God-given right for white Americans to dominate and destroy anyone not subjugated to their ways, especially African Americans, Arabs, and Jews, based on the investigations of Chris Hedges, author of American Fascists. Just to be clear, the difference between Christian nationalism and Christian fascism is that Christian nationalism particularly pertains to America. Decrying Christian nationalism is not an attack against Christianity or Christians. Christians act like Jesus. Christian nationalists act like the Antichrist. The two are as different as water and poison. The fact Jesus commissioned his disciples to take the gospel to the world, including the Gentiles, reveals the inclusive nature of the church, aka the kingdom of God. But Christian nationalism not only conflates national identity with Christian identity, but it also views diversity as a threat to its main objective of a religious and ideological monolith, hence its exclusive discriminatory nature. No American political figure is as well known for Christian nationalism than Gerald L.K. Smith. Though his role seemed insignificant at the time he ran for president against FDR, he is known for riling up the first American Christian nationalist base. And today, America seems to be paying the price for it, as a mere handful of Christian nationalist fascists presently hold the entire Republican conference hostage to their extremist agenda. Christian nationalists believe America was founded on and should therefore operate by strict Christian principles, and that government should take action to enforce that it remains that way. I think that when independent and democratic observers first begin to notice the rise of Christian extremism in America, an attempt to call out Christian nationalism, it was miscommunicated that Christian nationalists merely held a Christian standard that came across as exclusionary to others. This is not a fair assessment. Christian nationalism is not a mere perspective. It is a behavior. Christian nationalism is the attempt, by pressure or by force, to subjugate others to a draconian, obsolete, white evangelical code of moral and religious behaviors. Christian nationalism, along with other similar extremisms, interpret national prosperity as the barometer of God's approval. They believe God has sanctioned their dominance over others. Manifesting the mystical global Christian empire as a reality justifies the means in their eyes, and so Christian nationalists are able to persecute non-Christians without guilt. Christian nationalists have been callous in this way for so long that I believe they have now developed a sense of a divine right to be able to dehumanize non-Christians. So whenever they talk about the other side or people across the political aisle, they cannot merely talk about them in a political manner. They have to also dehumanize them. So they can't just be immigrants, they must be criminals. They can't just be pro-choicers, they must be murderers. Not just transgender, but perverse. Not just liberal, but manipulative and disrespectful of the traditions of others. But there is just one problem. Dehumanization is more than just sick. It is sickening. The longer the Christian nationalist movement pumps this rhetoric into the far right, the more nihilistic the Christian nationalist movement becomes. More after this. Hey, want to stay up to date on the latest anti-podcast episodes or be the first to hear the cinematic audiobook release date for Kingdom of Gold? Just head on over to my website, kaylin.info, to stay up to date on all the things you need to know. That's kaylin.info. You can also stay connected with me by following me on Instagram or TikTok. You can find all of my social media handles on my website at kaylin.info. That's kaylin.info. Entitlement. It is generally white ignorance and white entitlement to success that perpetuates cruelties such as Christofascism, Christian nationalism, and Christian capitalism. Chris Hedges sears the evangelical right for their worship of capitalism over Christ. He describes their mentality this way, quote, "Wealth, fame, and power are manifestations of God's work, proof that God has a plan and design for believers. This new class of celebrity, plutocrat Christians fuses with a consumer society, one where the lives and opinions of entertainers, the rich and the powerful, are news." He also says, quote, "This new oligarchic class is creating a global marketplace where all workers, to compete, will have to become like workers in dictatorships such as China, denied rights, their wages dictated to them by the state, and forbidden from organizing or striking. After all, anything that drains corporate coffers is a loss of freedom, the God-given American freedom to exploit other human beings to make money. The marriage of this gospel of prosperity with raw global capitalism and the flaunting of the wealth and privilege it brings are supposedly blessed and championed by Jesus Christ." End quote. Because this Christian capitalism, which benefited white supremacy, was sanctioned by God, it remains to be one of the strongest entitlements of the far right. And anyone who retaliates against this, even for righteous reasons, are still seen as going against the will of God. Me personally, being a creature of logic, I would call Hedges' analysis hypervigilant and far-fetched if America wasn't an oligarchy. If America was a legitimate democracy, I would have dismissed Chris Hedges as a hater of the right. But, quote, "America is an oligarchy with moments of democracy," end quote, spoken by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Because Christian supremacy over perceived outsiders or the otherwise undeserving had become an entitlement for white Christian extremists in the West, now it could be easily weaponized against them, since they would be the most unsuspecting. Some of the world's most brutal dictators have known for years that the people who are most susceptible to their influence are, you guessed it, Christofascists, Christian capitalists, and Christian nationalists. The reason? They chase power, and therefore the only thing that they will be legitimately attracted to is more power, or something more powerful. The belief that their desire to subjugate the world under them is God-sanctioned. It is this sense of divine entitlement that anesthetizes their consciences from any conviction for their underhanded immorality. Because Christian extremists tend to gain political power through grievance politics, all dictators have to do is empathize with their grievances, and then convince them through effective propaganda that their own democracy is useless and that it needs to be replaced by a stable and more effective dictatorship. Dictators don't even have to lift a finger anymore, thanks to algorithmic oppression. All they have to do is post a few insidious messages online and let online algorithms handle the rest. Before they know it, far-right extremists and Christian nationalists have consumed and recirculated this propaganda enough so that it creates an online presence and life of its own. Just that easy, a dictator can invade and acquire control over a major faction of a foreign country. And because they are driven by grievance politics, they will lead themselves straight into the dictator's arms. Why waste precious military and energy resources on overthrowing a democracy when you can convince the democracy to cave in on itself? Dictators have mastered using white supremacist entitlement against itself. Dictators create the trap by achieving one of the political agendas of the far right by using some form of cruelty. Far rightists then applaud the dictator, go out and apologize his tactics in other rightist rallies or events, meanwhile circulating the dictator's often fascist propaganda. As long as the dictator's abusive power and violent rhetoric are coming from a more familiar source, rightist party members, even those who are more moderate, listen with lowered defenses. They are more likely to accept the information as acceptable, and a percentage of those listeners often either quietly support or vocally echo some of the fascist propaganda and violent rhetoric. And again, usually the blind spot for many of these vulnerable members is divine entitlement to Christian supremacy. Looking at this tactic through a psychological lens, I call this dictatorial invasion strategy secondhand seduction. Abusers often use victims they have converted into other abusers to seduce more skeptical persons into becoming their new victims. Secondhand seduction is the abuser essentially convincing the target that his destructive abuse is necessary, so that they willingly submit to the abuser on their own. I knew that secondhand seduction of other nations was antichrist activity, but I did not realize how much the American political right had truly been impacted until the 2022 midterm elections. Like many other average, everyday Americans, I was blinded. Until it started happening to the U.S., I honestly did not realize that what I had put off as another round of apocalyptic panic was actually four alarm sirens blaring for the entire world to wake up. I never before thought it was fair to call dictatorship satanic, but I finally had to admit to myself that it absolutely was antichrist. Drill. Even before Revelations was written, nearly every generation has believed that it was witnessing the end of all time based on relative calamities in their day. The last day of the world and the coming of Christ have been falsely predicted many times, and the anticipation is understandable. It does feel safer to anticipate danger than to be caught off guard by it. Despite the fact that Jesus said, "No man knows the day of his return," predictions are still being made. But Matthew 24:32-33, and Jesus' parable of the wise virgin states that there is a remnant of believers who live ready for God's return, not by staying locked up under church arrest or something, but by bringing the gospel to the weary and the tired, and to the best and the brightest. Not the false gospel that says Christianity saves, but the true gospel that says Jesus saves. But if it is common of every generation to see antichrist activity in their time, how can I say that the present antichrist activity is the real deal? As I previously admitted, I did think that the present antichrist movement was just another apocalyptic panic. January 6th, the year of coups, the outrageous police brutality, the unexplainable hatred against women and immigrants, the rise of the American fascist leaders, I blew it all off and really believed that at some point it would genuinely get better. What changed my mind was after I exegeted two things, Daniel 11 and also the end time event known as the Abomination of Desolation. Jesus prophesied his return in Matthew 24. In verse 15, Jesus stated that his prophecy was based on Daniel's apocalyptic vision, revealed in chapter 10, but interpreted in chapters 11 and 12. On one layer of exegesis, Daniel's vision foresaw the rise and fall of a brutal Greek dictator, Antiochus IV Epiphanes. But another layer reveals that this vision was simultaneously an eschatological or end-time prophecy of the rise and fall of the Antichrist. As there was only one Epiphanes, there will be only one rise and one evident fall of the Antichrist system. And just as Epiphanes carried out his mission through cruel autocracy, so would the Antichrist. Based on the historical events that we have reviewed today, the official rise of the Antichrist was during the 1900s. The fall of it is yet to play out. Prior to properly exegeting this vision of Daniel, I initially thought Epiphanes sent his army on civilians only. But I learned that the Daniel 11:31 transliteration of the word sanctuary in this context is actually a fortress, not a mere civilian temple. This means that what I misunderstood as purely military was actually political. Secondly, the Abomination of Desolation event during Epiphanes' rule was the erection of a Zeus statue in the temple. It was a disgusting abuse of power and appalling to see in the house of God, hence the name. But remember, this vision has a dual interpretation. Based on Jesus' prediction in Matthew 24, 16 through 22, the end-time analysis of the Abomination of Desolation predicts a national event with the power to affect global economy and trade, and even drastically change population numbers for surrounding nations, whether by flight or by casualties. How could one nation be capable of all this? It could only be possible if the entire world order is assaulted and threatened, like if a dictator violated international law to illegally invade a neighboring country, illegitimately stealing control of its food, land, energy, and defense supplies, and by committing humanity crimes against civilian targets. For then, Matthew 24:21 says, shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. Jesus was saying there would be something about this martial law invasion that would be politically unprecedented, because contrary to previous times, this would not only affect the immediate region, but also impact the entire world. Daniel 12:7 reads, only when he has completely shattered the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished. If we understand this from the end time analysis, the interpreting angel was letting us know that when the dictator had completely shattered the power of the people that he was trying to illegally take control over, would his operation be overthrown and ended. This scripture is describing nihilistic behavior from the highest levels of government, which leads to world order disruption and quite possibly another world war. The astoundingly little regard that people tend to have for one another or for humanity in general today is not a mere sad outcome. It is a sign that the world is currently suffering from another nihilistic outburst, just like the one that preceded World War I. The first nihilistic movement thrived during the economic hardships prior to the world wars. Nihilism is the essence of destruction, because nihilism sees that the only way to true freedom is to destroy anything in the way. Essentially, nihilism is my way or I will kill you. There are most certainly others, but no national figurehead has epitomized this creed more than Vladimir Putin, especially since his unjustified invasion of Ukraine. World order has been disrupted before, but not by nihilism, and not in a way that Putin disrupted it back in February 2022. This ongoing war in the East is why I am now certain today's Antichrist activity is not a drill. Dehumanization. The Antichrist must act jointly with the false prophet system and the devil, because the devil knows that in order to effectively challenge God, he must address all three eternal persons of the Godhead at once. The false prophet system was established first, and then it gave rise to the Antichrist system. but this destructive duo is still insufficient without the devil. But remember, the devil is a spirit. The devil is not going to show up in a suit and red horns. The devil is going to act through people. But how can we tell whom he is acting through? 1 John 3:10 says it best. By this, the children of God and the children of the devil are obvious. Anyone who does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor the one who does not love his neighbor. I think legalistic Christians tend to abuse the term righteousness, which is why it's really easy for them to use it to condemn other people or hold others in contempt. Righteousness literally means justice. Amos 5:24, therefore, is not a compound thought, but a singular one, called a parallelism. The prophet Amos basically said the same thing twice, which was common in biblical Jewish literature. Righteousness, therefore, is not doing the right thing to maintain a certain reputation. Righteousness is doing right by your neighbor. If I focus on treating my neighbor well, I won't have to worry about my reputation, because when I seek the kingdom matters first, everything else that I need will follow. Unrighteousness is therefore injustice or dehumanization. It is practically impossible to be unjust towards someone without dehumanizing them first. This is what makes it easier to step on a roach than it is to step on a person. Dehumanization takes the guilt out of an action that is wrong so that one can maintain whatever advantage one sees as necessary. Dehumanization at its worst is not a mere philosophy, but rather a need, one that is never satisfied. It always needs more in increasingly larger amounts. Without someone to destroy, dehumanizers feel starved and are generally incapable of humanizing themselves. The only people who dehumanize are the ones who feel the least human. But there are two ways to not feel human. There is to feel less than human, and then there is to feel above humans. The latter is particularly dangerous. Which brings us to the culminating point. What the white Christian slave owners and supremacists created, Gerald L.K. Smith politically weaponized. What Smith weaponized? Someone even worse, exploited. In the first episode, we learned about the operations and endgame of the Antichrist. In this episode, we are learning about the development and establishment of it. We must know more than just the inner wiring and operations of the Antichrist. We also need to see the blueprints. The operational system of the Antichrist will show us that it has destructive programming. But only the blueprints will reveal to us that this destructive programming is not a retaliation or even an impulse. It's a need. This is crucial to understand, because retaliation can be appeased, impulse can be managed or brought under control, but a need can neither be given nor taken away. A need cannot be argued with. Ignoring a need long enough cuts one's life short. If I stop eating, if I stop drinking water, if I ignore my body's pains and sicknesses long enough, I will jeopardize my life. A need is an ultimatum. Either tend to it or die. So what does the Antichrist do when its need is wicked? Same thing we do with our needs. We prioritize our needs. We respect our needs. We meet our needs. If I am hungry and I don't have money for food, the only way I can meet my need without suffering from long-term starvation is stealing. And guess what? Because my hunger is a need I cannot escape, often a reasonable person will forgive my theft of food. A need has an immunizing quality to it. The Antichrist knows this and does not need to convince itself or its followers that its destructive endgame is necessary. The Antichrist is rather wired to convince its target that its destruction is necessary. Let's explore an example of this very strategy through one of the greatest intelligence handlers, quite possibly of all time, Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin. Thanks to his experience as a spy, Putin is masterful at acquiring, studying, and exploiting information about other nations, and he has been faithful in using said exploits to dehumanize others in the worst ways. During his first years as Russia's permanent president, Putin often ordered bizarre kill-them-all strategies against Chechenian terrorist activity in Russia so that he could show himself as Russia's new strong leader. In two major terrorist strikes, Putin did kill all the terrorists involved, but at the expense of the hostages inside. In both cases, Putin killed way more hostages than the terrorists did. But Putin wasn't just doing this to gain the fawning adoration of his own citizens. He was doing this to get the attention of other national and international leaders who valued his extreme counter-terrorist measures. And it is no surprise that he drew mass attention from Western Christian extremists on the far right. American evangelicals in particular were enthralled and inspired by Putin's extreme counter-terrorist tactics. Malcolm Nance, author of The Plot to Betray America, says, quote, "Putin's utter ruthlessness was widely admired by American conservatives. As a counterterrorism professional studying these incidences, I often spoke to U.S. Army Special Forces members, Navy SEALs, and FBI agents, and found that many had starry-eyed admiration for how Russians crushed the terrorists, without regard for loss of innocent life. They would all talk about the horrible massacre at Beslan, how the Russians did not care about anything other than killing the tangos, a euphemism for terrorists. A number of military and police experts launched new careers by lecturing around the country in conservative forums about the two hostage barricades at Beslan. The consensus from these peers was that America needed to be equally as ruthless. To many American conservatives, Putin's resolve was a sign of a leader they could follow." End quote. Many Christian extremists view this behavior as purely righteous because eradicating the sinful is more important to them than saving the sinner, or even the righteous, apparently. They viewed the hostages as necessary damage, and that they would be granted martyrdom in heaven anyway. They were tired of the compassionate, woke, liberal Christians that allowed sin to slide or seemed to build a tolerance for sin, even if it was to give the unbelievers a chance to find belief in Jesus for themselves. Putin knew that this behavior would be well received by the extremist right, because unlike most, Putin actually understands the political spectrum and how it is ranked from least extreme to most extreme, not from one extreme to another. In a better model, the political spectrum is more of a compass, but the same ranking order still applies. But that's another topic for another day. What we need to see is why far-right extremists fell for Putin's secondhand seduction scheme. I do not believe that their hatred of the terrorist was the main driver that made Putin's merciless violence so attractive to far-right Christian extremists. I actually believe it was their repressed disappointment in God. Them. I do not believe that the Pharisees were holding the woman caught in adultery on trial as much as they were holding Jesus on trial. I do not believe that Jonah was as angry with the Ninevites as much as he was angry with God. I do not believe that Paul was legally and theologically after the Christians as much as he was challenging God, hence God's rebuke at him in Acts 9 verse 4. I do not believe the extremist Christian right is as disappointed with the Christian left as much as they are disappointed in God. Jonah was offended when God showed the same grace to the Ninevites that he had shown to him in the belly of the fish. The Pharisees were afraid that the gracious gospel of Jesus Christ really was the end of their religious supremacy. I do believe the extremist Christian is disappointed that God saw past the sin so that he might save the sinner. Especially when he does that for a sinner a Christian extremist believes is unworthy of grace. Even though such beliefs rest on the lie that God's grace is somehow earned and not freely given, it is still a theological challenge that many wrestle with even now. But Paul got it. Paul saw his error and realized, if God saved me, why exactly am I turning around and trying to keep sinners away from God? As if God's holiness can somehow be tainted by them. Decades after Paul's ministry, Christians would soon read the passage of St. Matthew 8:10-12, which, I remind you, is written in red. That passage tells me that heaven will not be full of Christians. Heaven is going to be full of believers. What is this passage? I'm glad you asked. Matthew 8, verses 10 through 12 is the middle of the account of the Roman centurion's faith in Jesus Christ. After marveling at the faith of one of his own oppressors in comparison to the Jews' tendency to doubt, Jesus turned to his own followers and said this, "Verily I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. And I say to you, that many shall come from the east and west, and shall sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in the kingdom of heaven. But the children of the kingdom shall be cast out into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Just to put things in perspective here, the children of the kingdom are Jesus' followers in that example. And the many that come from the east and the west, that's a Gentile reference. The heathens, the heretics, the S word, yes, the sinners, those people, you know, them. Do you know what extremism is? Often extremism is an allergic reaction of sorts to a wrong committed by, quote unquote, them, whether this wrong is perceived, real, or both. Yes, sometimes extremism can be a corrective, and we do need healthy doses of extremism from time to time. But Christian nationalism, specifically the 45 kind, is a backlash in and of itself. It goes too far. It's not corrective at all, it's punitive. It's not law-abiding, it's legalist. God does not correct us because he hates sin. He corrects us because he loves us. Correction is love, not a punishment. One kind of extremism that Christian nationalism tends to cause is religious polarization. In this country, we always hear about political polarization, but we never talk about religious polarization, which is funny because often religion and politics are neighbors. They live across the street from one another. Because both societal influences are able to organize, persuade, energize, and mobilize people, religion and politics often have a lot in common. For the most part, religion is politics with a God in it, and politics is religion with a ballot box. Whereas political polarization is our way against theirs, religious polarization is us against them. And when Christians see themselves as the victors of the world, more than they see others as the children of God, they inevitably develop a church versus world mentality. Religious polarization in its ugliest form. The Antichrist operation that is actively converting far-right Christian extremism into nihilistic and fascist outbursts is literally powered by divine disappointment. The Christian extremist often chooses their own interest over others, so they expect Jesus to be the same way. They expect Jesus to only be loyal to himself, not them. And it is for this very mentality that I believe the Christian extremist will find their eternal soul in the place of weeping and gnashing of teeth, because they truly find the love of God confusing. Even if they were to bring themselves to truly understand the love of God, they would only wag their heads in disappointment and complain. God, how dare you? I can't believe that you would actually choose them over you. I did. This anti-episode was written, edited, and produced by me, Valerie Howard, thanks to the all-in-one podcasting app, Anchor. For access to all citations and references for this episode, please click the episode link, which will take you directly to the website page. Please like and share this podcast if you enjoyed it, and feel free to rate and leave a review. Next time on Anti. Every group along the political spectrum is not a stagnant ideology. This goes for the leftist, the moderates, and the rightists. Each group is merely one part of an entire process we call the political spectrum. The left side of the political spectrum tends to be more developed and advanced, whereas the right side tends to be more primitive. There is no one part of the spectrum in which any group of people is supposed to stay forever. In fact, the ideal is for everyone to keep moving along the political spectrum. Politics that has a consistently moving body of people will survive longer. This is why it was healthy for our democracy to pendulum swing between the control of the Democrats and the Republicans. It is as unhealthy to remain at any one part of the political spectrum as it is to remain asleep all the time. Just like the human body, politics is supposed to be constantly moving in a continuous cycle, hence the compass-like model of the political spectrum.